that, let us proceed. Attorneys, you may approach. Murray versus Stein. Yes, I'm sorry if you didn't hear me. Now, it's my understanding that both sides have up to 15 minutes. Is that?
No, that's it.
Okay, I retract that. You may have up to, I'm sorry, I've got my cases confused here. Both sides have up to 10 minutes.
And would it be possible for me to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal because there's a cross appeal?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. May it please the court. In this case, the appellant argues that the trial court made three primary errors. First, requiring the plaintiff to make a factual showing about the dates on which the trust owned the stock. Second, failing to find that a demand was futile. And third, failing to find that this is not a situation in which the court should allow an equitable exception and allow a direct action to go forward.
Counsel, before you dive into the errors, do we have a final order? Do we have a final judgment in front of us?
Yes, Your Honor, we do.
What about the attorney fees that haven't been ruled on?
All of the cases that this court has decided in which it has said there was no final order because of attorney's fee, the court has reserved ruling on that issue.
Salkin versus Jacobson?
That's the only exception. However, in this case, there were requests for attorney's fees in each of the answers in front of the court.
But there were also separate motions for attorney fees.
Separate motions later. However, if you will look at the record, if the appellees did not believe that that was a final order, they had 10 days in which they could have filed a motion to alter or amend and ask the court to hold, to change the order and make it a not final order so that they could have their attorney's fees heard. The notice of appeal was not filed until after the deadline for a motion to alter or amend, and then it was filed at that time.
If Salkin versus Jacobson controls, where are we?
I believe that we still have a final order.
And what's your articulation for that?
The court made a final order, and I believe it's partly a practical decision. If the court makes an order and says it's a final order, but there's something in between on which the court has not reserved, because the court did not reserve, and in every other situation such as this, the court has said, no, they reserved it, so it was not a final order.
Do we even know if the court knew about the motions? I mean, the summary judgment hearing was held, then the motions are filed, and then we have a ruling that's silent.
Yes, Your Honor.
The record doesn't tell us, does it?
I don't know. I don't know what the judge knew, but I do believe that we had that 10-day window, and if the appellees had wanted the court to alter or amend and say, I'm going to hold attorney's fees for consideration, as is done, has been done in many cases, they should have done that and brought it to the court's attention. Because then that would put appellants in a situation of not knowing when there is a final order. And that was basically what Judge Ashford said at the hearing was, you know, I said it was a final order, and as long as that appeal's there, I don't have the jurisdiction because I've made this a final order.
Do you think that a district judge, other than the section 25.13.15, which has specific requirements for its application, has the power to determine what's final and what isn't just by saying so?
Well, I believe that they have the power when they believe that everything has been submitted to say this is a final order, and that if that was an error under the circumstances, it could have been addressed by a motion to alter or amend rather than waiting and filing an appeal.
We clearly have disagreed with that concept in the situation where there's the unruled upon counterclaim that everyone forgets about.
That's true. But there's a difference between a counterclaim that's part of the same singular cause of action versus a subsequent motion for attorney's fees.
Do you think if this was a final order, if it was, do you think that the district court would have the power after our remand, whatever we do, to rule upon the attorney fee motions that were filed during that interim period of time?
If this court decides that it was not a final order, yes, they would have the authority.
But the other way around, if we decide it was a final order, for whatever reason, have they just lost those attorney fee motions under Salkin?
Yes. There are many instances where if you do not submit it timely, then you lose your right to do something. They not only had the opportunity to have submitted motions for attorney's fees at the time of the summary judgment hearing, but then they had the opportunity to ask for a motion to alter or amend if they believed that the court should have addressed the attorney's fees at that time.
So your rule would sort of be Salkin plus. You not only have to file the motions before the final judgment, you have to somehow alert the trial court, don't rule on, because at the time they filed those motions, they couldn't have filed a motion to alter or amend.
Right, but when the summary judgment order came down, which I will admit was sooner than I believe any of us expected the order would actually get entered, then that, I believe, would have been the proper way to address it. And since they did not move to alter or amend, but rather waited, they did not appeal that order either. They waited until 30 days from a hearing that I believe was about a month or more later, and then appealed from that when the court said it did not have jurisdiction.
Okay. I'll stop interrupting.
That's perfectly fine. Because what I was going to say next was we believe that the judge was right to say that he didn't have jurisdiction under the particular facts of this case when the summary judgment came down. It was a final order. There was no motion to alter or amend. There was no appeal from the court's failure to address the attorney's fees at that time. And it wasn't until 30 days after the court had held the hearing saying that they had no jurisdiction that they raised that issue. But going to the facts of the main case, in this case, this court has allowed an exception and allowed a direct action to go forward in cases where there was a closely held corporation with, for example, three shareholders. In this case, it was the exact same circumstance. 304 Corporation, which wholly owned the bank, was owned entirely by three families, each of whom had a representative on the board. At some point, there was a disagreement between the families, and two of the families brought in this Mr. Stein to manage the bank. We believe that one of the primary errors of the district court was finding that Mr. Stein, despite having full control of the bank and everyone else's assets, had no fiduciary duty. This court has never found a situation where someone who had actual authority to control someone else's money, interests, or investments did not have a fiduciary duty. Based on that fiduciary duty and the fact that the two families brought in Mr. Stein, we believe not only did the Children's Trust owning the shares of stock for the Fiddle family have a unique injury, but even if they didn't, there should be an equitable exception allowing them to pursue the value that was lost when Mr. Stein managed the bank in such a way that its assets were reduced to virtually nothing. And Mr. Stein was allowed to take over the bank in the name of Purdom State Bank without a payment. The bank was worth at least $1 million just very shortly before this. We believe that information was not sent out to other banks who had requested it. And this was all done under Mr. Stein's management. And this court said in Aon Consulting that it's the actual authority. In that case, it was the opposite situation. The person had the title, but they didn't have any authority. In this case, Mr. Stein refused to take a title or to sit on the board as board member, yet he controlled all the decisions of the bank from the day he was brought in. And he admitted that he had wanted to buy that bank since before he was brought in. And he did, at a very, very good price, virtually nothing. So we believe that the court should fashion an equitable exception in this case, allowing the shareholders, the Murray Fiddle's Children's Trust, to go forward and not have to meet the demand requirements of a standard derivative suit, because it's a closely held situation. It's futile to ask the Lindsay family to sue itself. So the demand should be excused, even if this is looked at as a derivative action. Or there should be an exception to allow them to pursue the loss that they incurred through Stein's management, which was directly to his personal benefit of taking over the bank. Now we also, I see my time is up for my main argument.
Thank you very much. Good morning, sir, and you are?
My name is Bill Hardage, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Hardage.
Yes. Appellees, Greg Stein and Premier Bank, but for purposes of the oral argument this morning, I'm the designated arguer for the other appellees, at least insofar as the issues are in common. I'd like to focus my comments this morning on two issues. First, whether the district court correctly dismissed those causes of action asserted by the plaintiffs, which were in the nature of derivative claims. And secondly, whether the district court was correct in granting summary judgment on those claims that were in the nature of direct claims.
Before you do that, would you like to weigh in on the jurisdictional issue?
Yes, Your Honor, the court lacks jurisdiction. For the reasons we've argued in our brief, we think Salkin controls. And we've struggled trying to harmonize the various cases on the attorney's fee issue, but it appears consistently this court has held that if there is a motion filed before the entry of judgment requesting relief in the nature of attorney's fees or costs, and that motion is not ruled upon by the court as part of the final or as part of the judgment, the court, that judgment is not final. And
do you think our Salkin case or any other cases that rely on Salkin speak to precisely what that date is? Is it entry of judgment? Is it rendition of judgment? Is it announcement of decision? Is it taking under advisement the dispositive summary judgment motion? What's the deadline?
For filing the motion for attorney?
Yes.
The entry of judgment, I believe, is what the rule is. And in those cases that the appellants rely upon, to the contrary, all arise in the situation where no motion was specifically filed before the entry of judgment. So, for example, in the Olson versus Pelagi case, there this court held that it was assumed that the district court must have considered a request for attorney's fees that was included in one of the pleadings as part of its judgment. But those are the only cases that the appellants can point to where the court has gone, say, astray from the holding in Salkin. And I would submit that as long as a motion is filed before the judgment is entered, that should be sufficient to preserve the issue of attorney's fees.
If that was, and I assume that was your understanding at the time that the district court ruled, why didn't the appellees file a motion to alter or amend as suggested by your opposing counsel?
Your Honor, I don't think a motion to alter or amend the judgment would have been a proper procedure to bring forward a request for attorney's fees. A motion to alter or amend judgment is to correct errors that the court has made based upon the record that was submitted to the court at the time the judgment was entered.
And your version would be, in short, you didn't have any quarrel with what the trial judge's judgment was. It just didn't address the attorney fees that your motions.
Correct. And we hadn't been given the opportunity to present our record on the motion for attorney's fees. That was going to be at a hearing scheduled for that purpose, which creates the situation we're in. Unfortunately, the judge didn't get a chance to hear that before he entered summary judgment.
The motions that were filed were properly noticed under the local procedures?
Correct.
So a review of the file at the time of rendition of judgment would have disclosed that these motions were pending and scheduled for a later hearing.
It would.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Addressing first the standing issue, I'd like to first of all comment on the argument that Appellant's counsel just made regarding the discretionary exception, as it's referred to, regarding standing. And clearly here, the claims that were asserted were injuries to Mid-City Bank that caused allegedly a diminution in value of the bank and hence the appellant's stock is clearly a derivative action. And there's really no argument advanced here to the contrary. The argument advances that there should be an exception to that. And I believe the case that counsel is referring to is the Truebauer case. And that case is distinguishable from this case in a couple of respects. First of all, this court held there that the case was admittedly a derivative action, but they held because there was a single shareholder suing the only two other shareholders, the recovery under the derivative claim could be paid directly to the shareholder plaintiff. So it wasn't really a question of whether it was derivative versus non-derivative action. It was a derivative action, but the recovery was allowed directly, which made sense there, because it wouldn't make sense to have the recovery be in favor of the corporation and then have the money dwindle down to the one shareholder that was suing. The big difference here, Your Honors, is we have the FDIC's involved. It's the FDIC that took over this bank. And that's why the plaintiffs were required to make a demand on the FDIC to bring this action pursuant to Nebraska Revised Statute 21-2072 more than 90 days before this lawsuit was filed, to give the FDIC an opportunity to investigate and decide whether it was going to bring this action or not. That's the difference between this case and the Truebauer case. Also regarding standing, the appellants filed five separate versions of the complaint in this action, plain and four amended complaints. One thing that was consistent throughout all of those versions of the complaint was that they never pled the date they acquired the stock in question. And that's fatal to a derivative claim under Nebraska Revised Statute 21-2071, which requires that a plaintiff in a derivative action plead that it had acquired the stock as of the time of the wrongful acts or omissions, or had acquired the stock by operation of law. The appellants concede, both in their main brief and the reply brief in this action, that they've never pled when they acquired the stock.
Could that be implied from the facts of the case?
No, Your Honor. In fact, I think that the argument that that should be inferred is not only wrong, I think the opposite is true. I mean, if anybody knows when the plaintiff trust acquired the stock in this case, it's the plaintiffs. I mean, why wouldn't they plead when they acquired the stock? Isn't that simple enough? Well, I would infer, Your Honor, that the reason they haven't pled it is because they can't establish that they own the stock at the time of the complaints, that the alleged acts or omissions in this case. Now, they do plead the legal conclusion that they acquired the stock by operation of law. But if you look at the facts that they plead to support that legal conclusion, in fact, it doesn't. They plead in paragraph 20 of their fourth amended complaint, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, that the plaintiff trust is the assignee of all causes of action which existed at the time of the transfer, and therefore, they have come into possession of the shares by operation of law. Well, an assignment, by its very definition, requires some affirmative act. A transfer by operation of law, by definition, is a transfer that occurs without any affirmative act. So if you look at the facts pled versus the legal conclusion, it's clear that they have not adequately pled that they acquired the stock by operation of law. And since they have not complied with 21-2071, their derivative claims were properly dismissed. I'd like to briefly comment on the claim against one of my clients, Mr. Stein. That was a claim for breach of fiduciary duty. First of all, although the district court held that based upon the facts pled, that there was not a basis for a claim for breach of fiduciary duty, the district court didn't need to get there because that claim, like claims 2 through 5, which it dismissed for lack of standing, is also a derivative claim. And so we really don't even need to address this issue of whether Mr. Stein, based upon facts pled, owed a fiduciary duty or not. But assuming you do decide to get there, I think the facts pled do not establish a breach of fiduciary duty. And the only case that appellants rely on that's anywhere close to the facts of this particular case is the Aon case. But as counsel for the appellants noted, that case is different on its facts. There you had a case where a lower-level officer in the company had the title of officer, I forget frankly, but he was vice president, and had some level of managerial control. Then, prior to the alleged breach of fiduciary duty, that person was stripped of his managerial authority, but he kept his title. And this court said, and it was careful in its language, it said, assuming that those managerial duties did give rise to a fiduciary duty obligation of that person, once those duties were stripped, the title in and of itself was insufficient. Well, here the district court correctly looked at the allegations of the Fourth Amendment complaint and determined that what was alleged in terms of Mr. Stein's duties did not rise to the level of managing the bank. What was alleged was that he acted as a consultant, that he made recommendations to the board, and the board acted on those recommendations. Did he, admittedly in the complaints, he never accepted the position of president. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there time for rebuttal?
She used all 10 minutes.
There is no time for rebuttal. We will go on to the next case of the day, which is State versus Jose C. Oliveira Cornejo. And Justice Wright is recused in this matter. Justice Stephan will be participating, and Judge Pirtle from the Court of Appeals will also be joining the court.